It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Lawmakers on the floor of the House of Representatives held a moment of silence Monday for their colleague, Congressman John Lewis, the civil rights leader who represented Atlanta in the House for 30 years. He died Friday night after a battle with cancer. Representative Lewis was a lifelong civil servant, often getting into what he called good trouble.
You know, I got arrested a few times during the 60s. 40 times. And since I've been in Congress, another 5 times. And I'm probably going to get arrested again for something. But my philosophy is very simple. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, say something, do something, get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble.
Longtime Pittsburgh public servant Salahuddin was a freedom rider with Representative Lewis. Salah, what does good trouble mean to you?
Good trouble reminds me of the old Negro spiritual, "Still Waters Run Deep." John was a kind of a still water, but he always ran deep. Even though he was soft-spoken, he was insistent upon challenging quiet norms, like you can't sit in the front of the bus, you got to sit in the back.
For those who don't know your story, you got into some good trouble yourself, pulled over for speeding after a rally in Mississippi. Police found an unloaded shotgun in the car. You wound up spending 7 months in federal prison. You received a presidential pardon 44 years later. You knew Representative Lewis quite well. Would you share a remembrance, a story with us?
The first time I heard John speak was when I attended the March on Washington in 1963. He was the youngest of a long line of speakers, and the rumor was going around that the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, was going to give a fiery speech. He gave a good speech, but I remember learning that he had been influenced by Roy Wilkins and some of the other older, more established traditional Negro leadership to tone his speech down. I remember the appeal that he had to young people who were in the crowd because he was young. Mm-hmm. He was only 23 years old. The impression that he left on so many of us who listened to him, including myself, his speech along with the speech of Dr. King called "I Have a Dream," those speeches are what influenced me to join the movement and to become a freedom rider.
How did that influence your own work?
At that time, I was 19 or 20 years old. I was trying to figure out who I was and what is my purpose in life? What am I going to do with my life? And that experience of the March on Washington, August 28, 1963, answered those questions for me in my mind. And I decided right then and there, I'm going to join this army. I'm going to hook up with these guys come hell or high water.
The nation lost two civil rights giants within 18 hours this past weekend, Congressman Lewis, of course, and Reverend C.T. Vivian, an advisor to Dr. King. Are you seeing a new generation taking over for them, building upon their accomplishments?
Absolutely. When you look at the persistence of the Black Lives Matter campaign that is on fire in every major city in response to the televised murder of George Floyd, that's the kind of persistence and fire that John Lewis brought to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1963. These people who are out in the street now are in their early 20s, the same way John Lewis was in 1963. He was only 23 years old. That age group of leadership is what's in the leadership now, and it is in the spirit of John Lewis getting into good trouble that puts them in the street, makes them block highways and block traffic and confront riot gear police, but they still have the persistence to trouble the waters and get into good trouble. Nelson Mandela said, "A lucha continua, the struggle continues. We each stand on somebody else's shoulders."
Pittsburgh school board member, former city councilor, longtime activist Salah Uddin. Salah, thanks for your time and your memories of Congressman John Lewis.
Thanks for calling, Kevin. You take care of yourself.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week on The Confluence, we're marking the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Where are we as a city, as a nation, in meeting those requirements? Paul O'Hanlon is the co-chair of the City-County Task Force on Disabilities. Paul, you have made the point that accessibility is an afterthought in Pittsburgh. How so?
Oftentimes, decisions are made about what the city wants to do, and then they consider accessibility after that.
So it's not part of the original planning?
Correct. We've been in this planning process for the bus rapid transit between Oakland and downtown since 2014, and yet disability activists are still being told that it's too early to talk about where handicapped parking is going to be. We keep trying to get the city to consider accessibility from the start.
Mm-hmm. In a recent op-ed that you wrote, quote, "When the city balances competing interests, the results do not always reflect an appreciation that access for people with disabilities is required by civil rights law," end quote. Give us an example here in Pittsburgh where people with disabilities have lost out to other interests.
Well, one of the burning issues for us is sidewalk dining. The city essentially says you can use half of the sidewalk for sidewalk dining, but they take the half of the sidewalk that doesn't have the telephone pole, the fire hydrant, the things that block the way of the pedestrians. We get the half with all of the obstructions, which, you know, for blind people particularly is problematic.
Businesses are required to allocate 20% of renovation costs to barrier removal. You claim the city ignores this requirement when it comes to entrances to buildings. How so?
Well, when you look at our local building code, it talks about barrier removal, but it doesn't require any priority. You can look around neighborhoods like Shadyside, Bloomfield, Garfield. You can walk down the main business district and see store after storefront that has usually just one step as a barrier. And most of these places have done renovations in the last 30 years. So the fact that our building code doesn't prioritize the entrance being accessible, it shows. And it shows after 30 years of supposedly it being the law of the land that these are supposed to be made accessible.
So is it up to the person with the disability to hold that business accountable, or does the city ensure that standards are met?
There's two different ways of looking at it. If, for example, as a private citizen, I encounter a business that isn't accessible, that has, for example, made renovations without making the entrance accessible, I have a right to sue them. But, you know, I just want to get in the door. I don't want to spend my life suing businesses. On the other hand, the city of Pittsburgh has duties under the ADA to promote the goals of the ADA. And the city is the one that essentially is licensing these businesses that are discriminating against me. And so I think it's something the city needs to be concerned about.
The election is just a few months away. What can realistically be done to make polling places, voting machines more accessible?
It's almost anybody's guess yet what we're going to be facing in November as far as COVID-19. But based on what we know right now, we're going to have all 1,300 polling places in Allegheny County that we typically have. Most of them are accessible. Now, that doesn't mean that every one of them are perfectly accessible, but we are getting better. My sense is that come November, we'll be probably as good as we've ever been.
Mm-hmm. Finally, briefly, one thing, near term and one longer term, what needs to be accomplished, changed, to make it more equitable and accessible, our city?
The thing that stands out to me is that people with disabilities having a problem getting through the sidewalk of business districts because they're sidewalk dining or sandwich boards and other obstructions cluttering the walkway, not being able to get into stores, not being able to get into offices because there are barriers at the entrance is a problem. And it's not just a problem in terms of being able to be a consumer. It means that those places are places you're not going to be able to work at because you can't even get through the front door. You can't socialize with people in those places. It is a major impediment to people with disabilities being able to just go about doing their business when we don't attend to accessibility. And so, unfortunately, that means that people with disabilities pay the price. It's sort of a shame after 30 years of the ADA being the law of the land that getting through on the sidewalk is becoming more and more difficult. So short term, those are the things I would want to change. Long term, I think that we need to really relook at how we do planning so that planning for accessibility is one of the first issues considered rather than one of the last issues. I think that we'd get better results cheaper and it would serve everybody better.
Paul O'Hanlon is the co-chair of the City-County Task Force on Disabilities. Thanks so much for your time, Paul.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Contact tracing is key to stopping the spread of coronavirus until there's a vaccine or viable treatment. Pennsylvania has brought down new COVID-19 cases since they peaked in April, but numbers are creeping up again. Keystone Crossroads' Laura Benchoff has this inside look at contact tracing in Montgomery County, the first place in the state the virus took off.
If you live in Montgomery County, don't be alarmed if someone like Neil Lader calls you up and asks you about your bathroom.
Now, do you have one or two bathrooms in your dwelling? Okay.
Lader used to work in sales. Now he's a contact tracer with Family Services of Montgomery County, one of four community organizations doing this work on behalf of the local health department and telling people how to properly stop the spread of the coronavirus.
Well, the bathroom you absolutely need to use. So after every use of the bathroom, you need to wipe it down. It's not fun. There's no way to get around it.
Every morning, he and about 30 other contact tracers working for the county get a list of new confirmed positives. Their job is to call them and go through a battery of questions.
Specifically, are you currently employed? Where did you get tested? Do you recall? Do you have a fever? Do you have a cough? We'll probably need to get the names and contact details of your friends who you were with in the park.
The goal is to get people who recently tested positive for COVID-19 to stay home and isolate, and then get the names of everyone they've been in contact with and get them to do the same thing. Over the last month, they've gotten nearly 2,000 names of people who were potentially infected by someone who tested positive. The interim administrator of the health department says they're able to get on the phone more than 80% of the people who test positive and about 60% of their contacts. Lader says this is his pitch to get people to participate.
If we can get in touch with these people, we slow down the spread. And this is really where people like yourselves and contact tracers like me can really make an impact on the community at this point.
If testing tells you where the virus is, contact tracing is what actually stops it by limiting the number of new people it can jump to. Josh Sharfstein, an expert at Johns Hopkins University, says you know it's working when you're not surprised by where new cases are coming from.
If more and more cases are coming about among people who are your contacts that you've helped get into quarantine, then you're basically hot on the trail of the virus. Eventually, the spread's going to go way down.
But to work well, contact tracing relies on a bunch of other systems and policies. For example, in Montgomery County, bars, restaurants, and businesses mostly reopened at the end of June, potentially making a contact tracer's job harder because it's more likely a sick person has been going out. Sharfstein, for his part, says he's been working from home and not going out.
So if I were to get sick, it would just be my family that would be the contacts, which would be pretty easy for a contact tracer to notify, versus someone who has been within 6 feet for extended periods of time and many people.
The Montgomery County Office of Public Health says most of its cases are among family members, although that started to change as people move around more. There's been examples of spread at restaurants, graduation parties, and among sports teams. Another issue is time. The longer it takes someone's test to come back, the more they may be exposing other people to the virus. Pennsylvania Health Secretary Rachel Levine says local labs work quickly, but companies like Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp are seeing long delays because they're overwhelmed with the national surge in cases.
Some of our delays are 7 days or more. That's a real challenge in terms of being able to tell people that they're positive and do isolation and then do the contact tracing.
Perhaps most importantly, contact tracers must build trust with everyone. Roberto Perez runs the contact tracing team with a Latinx-serving organization called Aclamo in Norristown and says their conversations with Spanish speakers are twice as long as those in English.
So what's the difference? The difference is because there is some type of a trust.
And that can be lacking in communities such as Latinx immigrants who've been disproportionately coming down with COVID-19. Perez says many are afraid their landlord will find out and they'll get evicted, or afraid their boss will and they'll get fired.
They get a little bit shy because they know that there's something wrong. For instance, they start feeling bad, but they needed to go back to work. They cannot stop working because they need to provide their families with food.
To help, contact tracers have been activating the local social safety nets so people who need to quarantine can receive food, housing, and legal aid. Compared to the rest of Pennsylvania, Montgomery County is relatively well set up to respond to the pandemic as a wealthier place that already has a health department. But one health official there still described their contact tracing program as, quote, building the airplane while we're taking off. Laura Benchoff, Keystone Crossroads.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, Doug Schugertz, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.